Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org. Hello, and welcome to Nature Now. I'm your host, Nan Evans, and my guest today is Dr. Jan Newton. She's from the University of Washington School of Oceanography. But first, let's hear this week's mystery sound. Just a tiny hint. This energetic little bird visited my bird feeder this past week. Also this past week, there's been a very lively discussion on Nextdoor. During one of those really cold mornings, Larry Holman, who lives in the Fort Worden area, was checking to be certain that his hummingbird feeder had not frozen over when he saw two Anna's hummingbirds whirling past him and falling to the snow together. Larry turned on his phone video and captured the scene, which he called Hummingbirds Making Snow Angels. The bird on the ground fluttered its wing a little, while the bird on top fluttered its wings constantly. They were belly to belly for several minutes. Larry thought the bird on the top might be a male and the one on the bottom was female. Given how low the light was, it's really hard to tell for certain. After several minutes, the birds separated and flew off. What were they doing? The speculation began. Was it hummingbird sex? Probably not. Joyce James of Uptown weighed in with the following information. Hummingbird sex only lasts from 3 to 5 seconds, as the male hummingbird has no external penis. No actual penetration takes place. Instead, the male presses his cloaca, that's a posterior opening, against the female's, and the sperm is passed along to fertilize the female's eggs. In zoology class, I learned the term cloacal kiss to describe this process. And then Pam Gray offered that she had never heard about or even seen birds mating in the belly-to-belly position. Well, I weighed into the Nextdoor discussion with a speculation that it could have been two males showing aggressive behavior trying to claim territory and access to the food. Anna's hummingbirds are certainly known for their aggressive behavior. I postulated that maybe one bird had knocked the other down and that accounted for their being in the snow, but Larry was fairly confident that it was a male and a female and noted that although it's early in the year, Anna's hummingbirds could be mating and nesting. Well, Pam Gray came back with another observation that perhaps since the birds seemed to be holding onto each other's feet just before they split, that seemed more like a fight than mating. Lastly, one of our local birder experts, Ken Wilson, weighed in, said he preferred the fighting explanation. He offered that he has two hummingbird feeders in his yard, and each feeder is owned by a single hummer. That individual sits perched near the feeder and aggressively chases away any hummer coming within 10 yards or so. For the most part, ownership has been successfully asserted because Ken now rarely sees aggressive encounters. So who knows exactly what Larry Holman's video shows, but go have a look for yourself. You can see the video either on Nextdoor or go to YouTube and search for Larry Holman Hummingbirds. So now on to my conversation and phone interview with Dr. Jan Newton. This is actually part two. She spoke on January 13th at the Port Townsend Marine Science Center's Future of the Ocean series. Well, we're back with Dr. Jan Newton, biological oceanographer at the University of Washington. And the last time we talked a lot about sort of characteristics of the water and how dynamic that is and how different it is. And of course, one of the things that everybody thinks about is ocean acidification and that as a growing issue. Just real quickly, Jan, describe what that is.
Sure. So CO2 in the atmosphere is naturally there, but through the process of combustion, so like a fire or a an engine in your car or your heater in your house, combustion produces more CO2. We produce CO2 when we talk also. Since the Industrial Revolution, we've really cranked up the amount that's in the atmosphere. And some of that CO2, about a quarter of it, maybe a little more, diffuses into the ocean. And in a way, that's a good thing. Otherwise, the greenhouse effect and the warming would be much stronger if that wasn't happening. But the problem is that that CO2 in the seawater reacts with the chemistry in the seawater, and it has an acidic reaction so that it is lowering the pH. It forms carbonic acid that then dissociates. And we'd have to get into a bit of complex chemistry, but basically the net result is that there's lower pH. The seawater is basic. It's around 8.1 or so. But as the more CO2 from the atmosphere has invaded the world oceans, including Puget Sound, through the air-sea interface, we have changed the seawater chemistry in a measurable fashion such that the pH is actually lower. So when the chemistry changes, the amount of CO2 dissolved in water is higher, the pH is lower, and the availability of carbonate is lower. And so now you've got three different things there. So you've heard of hypercapnia, right, from too much CO2 in people's blood. Well, as we have too much CO2, or more than what was naturally there to begin with, that can affect organisms, that you've changed the pH. pH is kind of like a master variable, they say. If the pH in your bloodstream changes, that can have major implications for humans, and so too for marine organisms. And one of the studies recently conducted here at the University of Washington showed that salmon don't smell molecules like their predator molecules, you know, scent from a hungry harbor seal. They don't smell that as well when the pH is lower or when the CO2 is higher.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
you know, I can think of, well, you know, if you've got more acidity, of course, those animals that have calcium carbonate in their shells or bodies are going to be affected. Mm-hmm. And in larval development, we hear from the oyster farmers that there are issues there. But salmon don't smell as well.
Right,
wow.
Right. So that's the thing, is that most people, when they think of ocean acidification, they think of the effect on the carbonate. And there's good reasons to think about that, you know, for the reasons that you said. And we have studied organisms, little pteropods, and when the waters have so much CO2 in them, their shells are actually corroded and can get holes in these shells because the waters are so corrosive. From the research cruises from the Washington Ocean Acidification Center, we've been taking these pteropod samples all throughout Puget Sound and off the coast. And yes, we find some areas, and they're the areas where there's the buildup of CO2. And so when you have like the low oxygen, high CO2 areas, like the deep waters in Hood Canal, Whidbey Basin, or during the height of upwelling off the coast, you're bringing up high CO2 waters. That mixes with the atmospheric signal. So it's just, you know, it's that extra bit that is tipping the balance. And people say that to grow oysters in Willapa Bay, 10% of the time, conditions were not conducive to that. But since the addition of the CO2 in the atmosphere, so since the pre-industrial times, we've changed that from 10% of the time to 30% of the time. And other investigators are doing similar sorts of calculations, because you can back calculate the anthropogenic effect and then put it in the context of the water column that you measure and see what the values are these days and what they would have been without that addition, and then put it in the context of the organism that you're caring about, whether it's an oyster larvae or a pteropod, or now trying to understand this effect on salmon. One of the things is that biologists are looking at the effects on organisms. And so, for instance, tiny zooplankton. We have copepods, we have euphausids. This is the stuff that whales and salmon eat. You know, it's all the diatom to the plankton, the forage fish to the salmon to the whale. Stronger effects on euphausids than on copepods. So that's interesting. So what is that telling us about how these organisms live and what implications do those have for the food web? Some things that we didn't anticipate, like you mentioned, you wouldn't have anticipated the effect on the salmon being able to smell their predators. It was found in some tropical fish. Who knew that salmon would have the same sort of response? They looked at black cod, and black cod seem more resilient towards that. So there's some differences between species that are fascinating, but there's also a lot of things that we're not very good at predicting. For instance, some of the researchers are finding that the harmful algal blooms, you know, the species that make the toxins right. that make people sick yeah. or worse, that some of those species are very resilient towards the high CO2 conditions and that they make more toxins when the CO2 is higher. So as we acidify, we might have more harmful algal blooms. So these are the things we really need to get a handle on if we're going to learn how to adapt.
So I, in preparing to talk to you, I ran across a description of a grant that you and some of your colleagues recently got from NOAA to better understand ocean acidification, you know, the changing of the coastal waters, coastal species, and its impact on sort of human communities. And you were doing this project with coastal tribes. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, I'd be happy to. It's really exciting for me, but it's also, you know, exciting for a sad reason, because we are changing the environment through ocean acidification, and not in ways that we might like or that will be conducive to the things that we want to do and depend on. But it is an opportunity to put our knowledge to bear on how can we inform ourselves the best. And so that's what this NOAA opportunity is. And I put in a proposal to work with a social scientist, Melissa Poe, at the University of Washington, and her team. And we combined forces with modelers and observational oceanographers and the tribes and the state of Washington, as well as the sanctuary and the Olympic National Park, anybody who had data on the outer Olympic coast, to understand what the impact of ocean acidification is going to be, but to do it in a social science context so that we're learning, the social scientists are learning, where are the dependencies on certain species, and then the natural scientists are putting together our synthesis of the data and then using models, forecast models, computer models, to look at, you know, where are the conditions the worst now and where are they going to change to be the worst? And so that then feeds back to the tribes and the other local communities to understand where are those choke points, right, that may make a difference. So that's what we're trying to do, and do it in a way that's very local, place-based. You know, when you think about ocean acidification, it's this huge global process, right? Global scale, but yet the effects are going to be very different depending on what kind of beach you're at. Are you near an upwelling zone or aren't you?
And sort of sensitivity to their predator awareness
right,
system.
Right.
So is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So the other thing to keep in mind here is that the tribal cultures are dependent on, you know, some of the species that we all know and,
sure.
and are common commercially exploited species like salmon and crab. But there's a lot of other species that are used and have been for millennia, you know, gooseneck barnacles, the little olive shells. And so understanding across a wider breadth of species and understanding where those choke points may be is really important. And then also understanding, because the Olympic coastline from north to south has a large variation in where the hypoxia is the strongest, the lack of oxygen, and where the corrosive waters are the most, and then also seasonally. So if we just understand this context better, then we can put that lens of human uses across it and start to see where should we be focusing some energy on what adaptation strategies would be best.
You've mentioned that you're sort of collecting this real-time scientific data, and you're trying to build ways to predict out what can possibly happen. Is that through computer modeling, or how does that work? How do you do
how
those predictions?
Yeah. Well, it's exciting because not only do we have natural scientists and social scientists working together, but we also have people who observe the ocean, and we have, for instance, a buoy off of Lapush. It's called Chaba, which means whale tail in the Quileute language. Huh. They helped us dedicate it. So that has observations. There's other buoys. And then there's scientists who use numerical models to calculate the same variables that we're observing. So there's a model called Livocean that calculates things like water temperature, oxygen, pH, chlorophyll, those sorts of things. NANOOS, the Northwest Association of Networked Ocean Observing Systems, serves both that buoy data and the model data. And so we are utilizing those sources of data to understand current and future characteristics of the ocean acidification conditions along the coastline. So that was a little bit of a mouthful, but let me just say that if you have like a forecast model, like you're getting your weather forecast, mm-hmm. right? And the weather, the meteorologists, they ground truth their predictions with the observations so that their models are getting better and better at these predictions. So too do the oceanographers. And so the measurements from like the Chaba buoy and in Puget Sound, from other measures from the University of Washington and the State of Washington agencies, that model gets better and better at those forecasts, all right? So you look at both what you have now, and then when you have a skillful model, not only can you forecast like 3 days in advance, but now you can put in climate change scenarios of what CO2 and temperature levels will be, let's say, at 2100, at the end of the century. And so you can project out, way out into the future and see.
So are we there yet? Or when will we be there where you can sort of reliably say this is what the model says?
We're there. And it's pretty exciting. If you go on to the NANOOS website, which is www.nanoos.org.
That's NANOOS. NANOOS?
You've got it.
Okay.
NANOOS. And you go to the NVS, the NANOOS Visualization System. There's a big button. People can't miss it. And you go to the models. You'll see that there's different models that are in our area from different modelers. I've been mentioning the Live Ocean one because that's the one that we're using in this project. But there are others. And what you can do is not only look at what the model says, but there's this little comparator button, and you can compare it to where the buoy data are. And so you can see how well the model's performing. And the scientists put so much time and energy to, you know, calibrating and verifying, and no model is perfect, but as some people say, no model is perfect, but some are useful. And
that's
and
a great
so,
way to think about it.
And you think about that, you know, the weather. I mean, it's getting better and better, the forecast,
but it's
right?
Not perfect.
But
yeah.
It's not perfect, but yet it's useful, right?
You know, we're getting to the end of our time, and I'm thinking, okay, the challenge for me and for listeners is to go on the NANOOS website and actually look at this stuff and see what
just
those predictions
it.
Look like. Yeah.
Just explore it. explore around. You don't have to look at what we've been talking about. But that's really my goal as my research has progressed, is not so much about satisfying my own innate curiosity about what's going on in the ocean, but getting that information out into the hands of the public so that they can see what's going on in this larger feature mm-hmm. of the planet. And also then we can use it to understand how we can make some decisions that will help us adapt to the changing climate mm-hmm. that we have.
That's a wonderful ending. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome, Nan.
Really,
it's been wonderful talking with you.
Now let's hear that mystery sound again.
Those were the songs and calls of ruby-crowned kinglet. These restless little olive-gray birds have a prominent white eye ring and two white wing bars. And then below the white wing bars is another sort of blackish bar, and then the lower part of the wings often have kind of a yellowish tinge. The ruby crown, of course, is only on the male, and it's only occasionally visible, usually only during the breeding season. I frankly have never seen the ruby crown. Let's see. Now with Nora Petra's help, let's look at upcoming events around our town.
Johanna King will present a program for the Admiralty Audubon Society on Thursday, February 21st at the Port Townsend Community Center. Recently, Johanna spent about a month in the eastern part of Australia. Come and enjoy this look at the natural history of Down Under. Find more information on the Admiralty Audubon website.
And in honor of the Jamestown Sklallam Recognition Day, which was on February the 11th, the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society is dedicating the month of February to learning more about the Sklallam and their relationship to the land. The first event is on Friday, February the 22nd. Check out the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society webpage for more information.
On Saturday, February 23rd, join the Jefferson Land Trust Geology Group for a presentation by Steve Cox, U.S. Geological Survey hydrologist, that answers a question, how old is our groundwater? For more information about the Geology Group, visit their website at quimpergeology.org.
Then on February the 26th, lend a hand to a great group of intrepid Quilcene students and neighbors to restore and replant a blackberry thicket-covered bank along the edge of the Big Quilcene River. The Jefferson Land Trust website gives details on when and where to meet.
The Jamestown Sklallam Tribe and the North Olympic Salmon Coalition are seeking volunteers to help plant native trees along the Dungeness River on Saturday, February 23rd. You can find more information about the importance of this restoration effort and the work party on the North Olympic Salmon Coalition website.
Well, that's it for this episode of Nature Now. But before we go, some of you may have listened last Thursday to the Love is Alive on KPTZ. You still have an opportunity to help build a new home for KPTZ. And especially for Nature Now, folks, if you call in or press the button on the website and mention Nature Now, you can come into the studio and have your choice of a lovely laminated bird checklist for the Olympic Peninsula, a guide to the night sky, and or Roger Torrey Peterson's 50th anniversary edition of the Field Guide to Western Birds. Thanks to our steadfast editing crew. Today's sound engineer and editor is Nora Petrich. Contact Nature Now hosts if you have comments, observations, or ideas. Email us at naturenow@kptz.org. And thanks for listening.
Today's musical selection by Dave Bartley from Seattle is Flash of Vermilion.